Dubbed the Explainer by Wired Magazine, Michael Wesch is a cultural anthropologist exploring the effects of new media on society and culture. Dr. Wesch graduated summa cum laude from the Kansas State University Anthropology Program and earned his doctorate in anthropology at the University of Virginia, where he pursued research on social and cultural change in Melanesia. After 2 years studying the implications of writing on a remote indigenous culture in the rainforest of Papua New Guinea, he has turned his attention to the effects of social media and digital technology on global society. His videos on culture, technology, education, and information have been viewed over 20 million times, translated in over 20 languages, and are frequently featured at international film festivals and major academic conferences worldwide. Dr. Wesch has won several major awards for his work, including a Wired Magazine Rave Award, the John Culkin Award for Outstanding Praxis in Media Ecology, and he was recently named an Emerging Explorer by National Geographic. Dr. Wesch has also received several teaching awards, including the 2008 Case Carnegie U.S. Professor of the Year for doctoral and research universities. He was named Kansas State's 2011-2012 Kauffman Chair for Distinguished Teaching Scholars, focusing on improving new media literacy across the campus. Would you please join me in giving a warm welcome to Dr. Michael Wesch?
It's certainly very inspiring just to be here, just to be in the presence of all of you. And I look forward to finding out what I might say in this context. So one thing that crossed my mind in preparing for this just a couple weeks ago, I was thinking about this great MIT professor, Seymour Papert. And Seymour Papert, about 20 years ago, had this great insight. He was working with some four-year-olds at a preschool, and one of these four-year-olds asked, "How do giraffes sleep?" And nobody knew the answer to this question. And it wasn't the age of the internet yet. You know, the internet was just kind of blossoming, and nobody had a cell phone in their pocket or an iPad to turn to. And so nobody knew. And so they just had all these theories bubbling up, but in the end, nobody knew. So then he goes home that day, and he has this whole library of books. And what struck him was how fortunate he was to have this library book so he could find the answer. But he also thought that it wouldn't be long before there would be this thing, and he called it the knowledge machine. He figured before long there would be this knowledge machine that could be accessed even by four-year-olds with a few simple gestures, and they could ask the question, "How do giraffes sleep?" As I was thinking about this, and I was in the middle of nowhere in Illinois while I was thinking about this, and I pulled out my cell phone, and I thought, well, how do giraffes sleep? And it turns out you can get 56,000 videos on YouTube about giraffes. And then you can go even further with that. You can, you know, if videos aren't your thing, you can look it up on Google Scholar, and you get these very sophisticated, analyses of how giraffes sleep. And this one explains that giraffes have this very unique way of sleeping. They don't sleep very often, and when they do, they curl their head around to their croup. Now, I don't know what a croup is, so I had to turn to Google Images, which there are, of course, tens of thousands of Google Images showing how giraffes sleep. And if you don't yet know what a croup is, this picture might explain it for you. And this is the age we live in. We live in the age of the knowledge machine. And what I'm here to tell you is that it means an absolute fundamental change in how we go about education and the ultimate goal of education. Because the knowledge machine, the trick about the knowledge machine is that it only works with questions. If you don't have questions, you have the world's largest distraction device. If you have questions, you have at your fingertips the most amazing knowledge machine ever invented, larger than all the libraries ever, and access to experts and a new way of communicating and connecting that humans have never experienced before. That's the possibility. But it all requires the question. It requires this love of questions, and you need that. And I want to pause for a second and talk a little bit about what questions really are. Think about what a question is. A question is, first off, the gateway to all significant learning. It's the gateway to all real learning. It's not grades that motivate us to real learning. It's a question. And I don't think it's a mistake that the word quest is right there in the word question, because the best questions challenge your taken-for-granted assumptions. They challenge you at a very deep level. And often the best answer to a question is another question. And so you find yourself on this lifelong quest, pursuing question after question after question. The second thing I want to mention about questions is that they have this profound capacity to connect us to new information. Of course, you know, so like you might just be thinking of a question that suddenly puts things together you hadn't thought of before. But even more interesting is just how questions actually allow us to connect to each other. It's no mistake that around the world, the most common greeting is a question. Like we constantly ask questions of each other as greetings. And it must be the most amazing thing that humans do, that we actually can invite each other into a meeting of minds. Like, it's amazing, right? It's just absolutely phenomenal. And it starts with a question. And the third thing I want to mention about the question is that it seems to signal a capacity for us to embrace our vulnerability, to embrace our sort of humbleness. Because when you ask a question, you'll notice in all languages, except for about 70, but the other 6,000 languages, we raise our intonation when we ask a question. And it seems that we share this feature with many animals. About 70 mammals have been counted that do this, and several birds, where there's a signal that you would give. If you want to tell somebody to back off, you lower your pitch. And you'd growl, essentially, right? And if you want somebody, if you want to submit to somebody, if you want to draw somebody in, you raise your pitch. So think of a dog who also uses these signals. They will growl when they want you to back off. They'll raise their pitch into a when they want you to come closer. And I think that's what we're doing when we ask a question. The reason why we raise our pitch is we're making ourselves small. We're embracing our vulnerability. We're inviting connections to others. And we're embracing the quest itself. And that can only be done by inviting connections and embracing our vulnerability. So if that's what a question can do, imagine what it is to live your life with questions and it really embrace them for the wonderful things that they can be. And I want to share with you my own story of questions that sort of inspired me. So I started in this classroom here at Kansas State University. I was an undergrad there. And I was sitting about 11 rows back, and I had this professor. This is an anthropology class, which is the study of all humans in all times and all places. I'm a small-town kid from Nebraska. And so as I'm hearing about humans from all over the world, my mind is being blown with every little fact that comes out. So around me, all of my friends are like dutifully copying down all the information so that they can do well on the exam, and my mind is just blowing up. And I realized the gift of that class was that I was not given answers. I was given questions about fundamental questions about who are we as humans? Why can't we get along, or how can we get along? Really deep fundamental questions about what it is to be human. And those questions burned in my soul in a way that I couldn't let them go. And so when I graduated, I moved to New Guinea. It was a space as different as possible from where I grew up in New Guinea. I just wanted to see something radically different. So I go to New Guinea, I fly into the capital city, and I have this idea that I'm just going to go around, I'm going to meet as many people who are as different as possible from me so I can learn more and more about the human condition. And so I put my backpack on the first morning. I'm just going to go from hotel to hotel, staying in different hotels around the main city, just getting to know everybody I can. And so I put my backpack on, I go out the gate, and these two guys are walking towards me, the first two people I meet in New Guinea, and they say, "Hey, Moni." Now, in New Guinea, they speak like a pidgin English, and "Hey, Moni" could mean one of two things. It could either mean good morning, like, "Hey, morning," or it could also mean give me your money. And so I say, I'm a small town kid from Nebraska, so like I'm thinking the best of people, and so I say, "Oh, morning, morning," you know, and they say, "No God, morning, morning," and they start tapping their pockets, and I now know what they're up to, but I decide to play kind of stupid and just see if I can sneak past them. And so I say, "Oh, morning, morning," and I try to step just off to the side, and as I step to the side, they step in front of me, and the one guy pulls his jacket back, and he's got this 2-foot machete in there, and he's about to pull this out, and I turn my back to him, so if he slashes at me, he'll just hit my backpack, and I start running, and I get around this corner, and fortunately, all the good people I thought I was going to meet were around the corner, and they chased these two guys off, and I walked to the airport, and so then So then I'm there at the airport, and I'm looking at the board of departures, and, you know, first one on the list is Brisbane, which international departure, going to Australia. And I thought, oh, that would be nice. You know, that's a great place to go. And down the list were a bunch of places I'd barely heard of. They were all smaller places in New Guinea, smaller villages. And I was sitting there thinking, Brisbane would be nice, but the answer to my questions is not in Brisbane. The answer to my questions is somewhere down the list. And so I decided to go as far as I might need to go to find those answers. And that's what a question can do for you. It can take you places you never thought you might be able to go. So I took on this next plane, just anywhere I could go, took another small plane, and then another small plane until I was flying into this little grass airstrip in the center of New Guinea. And I land, and this is my greeting when I land here. And, you know, the plane only comes in about once every 6 weeks, so the plane leaves, and then I'm back here again. And I decide I'm not far enough. I need to just keep going. I mean, this is what a quest does, right? These questions are burning in my soul. I need answers. I'm going to keep going. So I walk a little farther, and I keep going for a couple of days, come across villages like this. I'm now really completely off the map, like literally off the map. These are places that had never been mapped. These are places where there's no electricity, no running water, no 3G access, no 4G access, no internet at all. And I've come, you know, across things like this, which apparently you're not supposed to be this close to cassowaries, but I'm a small town kid from Nebraska, and I don't know these things. And so then I come into this village here, and I end up staying in this village off and on for the next, off and on for the next 8 years. I spend almost 2 years there. And I come into this village, and I stay in this house over here. You can see where the two kids are standing. And I'll just give you a quick tour around here. They raise their own food. They grow taro, sweet potato, bananas. They raise pigs. So this would be like a big feast for them. They harvest spiders. They capture snakes. Snakes are kind of a good deal because snakes get lazy after they eat. So you can generally catch a snake really easy right after it's eaten. Then not only do you get the snake, but you also get the appetizer. And this was found soon after I arrived. So this is about a week after I first arrived. And these are actually my legs. You can see they're up in the upper right-hand corner. And we ate that snake that day, and I'm looking around this hut, and I'm thinking, gosh, there's holes everywhere. A snake like that could crawl in any time. And you know, we're only about 100 feet from where that snake was captured. We ate the snake, so I think my snake karma might not be that good. That snake might have family. You know, I mean, there's all kinds of issues. And so I wrapped myself up in that sleeping bag super tight, and I actually thought of it. I was like, this is my little America. I'm just going to hide in my little America, you know, just seal off the world. And but it's the tropics, so it gets hot. In the middle of the night, the sleeping bag comes off of me, and I wake up that very night, and I can feel this thing laying across my chest. It's about this big around, just laying right here. And so I grab it with my left hand, and I threw it off of me. But as I threw it, I rolled with it. So I'm wrapped up with this thing somehow. And I managed to get it pinned down on the ground with my left hand. And I try to free my right arm so I can pin it down with two hands, but I can't move my right arm. It's about this time I realize I've actually pinned down my own right arm like this. And my arm had just fallen asleep and was across me like this. So there actually was no snake. And there's a ton of funny stories I could tell you in these moments, but the reality is that this was actually the darkest time of my life. And I realized why that was sometime later. And what it was this. I thought, being a small town kid from Nebraska, I'd spent a lot of time figuring out who I was, shaping myself, creating an identity. And I thought that was identity was something inside of me that I projected outward. And when I was suddenly in a world in which nobody knew me and nobody understood me and all those things, I started to realize that who we are is actually reflected back to us by the people around us, by people who love us. And if you're suddenly in a world where nobody understands why you're there or what you're doing or who you are, you suddenly start to ask the same questions. And so I was basically whittled down to nothing. I felt like I had no self. The beauty of that, there's a lesson there, right? There's this lesson that our connections matter, that how we treat others matters, that it affects their identity directly. And there's another lesson, though, as well. As I lost myself, I actually found myself broken down to a point where I could learn faster than I've ever learned in my life. There was actually an upside to that. And I started realizing what it is to really move past your assumptions and start to open up to people and to others. And in that regard, I had these amazing teachers. And I'll just tell you a story here. I was walking along this ridge at one of my lowest moments, and I was feeling so sad. I don't know if any of you have ever experienced this, but I was feeling so sad that it became a physical thing. Like I felt weak, physically weak. And I started to just collapse along this ridge. And I ended up in a fetal position just crying along this ridge. And it was all the worse because I was looking at this. I was looking at this magnificent landscape, one of the most beautiful, majestic places I've ever seen. And I feel that. I was just feeling so sad. And I thought, how can I feel so sad with this in front of me? So I'm just crying there on the side of this mountain. And these two guys were walking behind me, come up beside me. And by the time they get to me, they're crying too. This was an amazing thing to me, was this capacity that they showed for empathy, that this guy they barely know, they just start crying with me spontaneously. And then they stop and they say, "What are you crying about?" And I said, the only thing I could think of, I said, "I miss my wife." And they started laughing and laughing, and they said, "Oh, we would never miss our wives." and then they started crying again, and they said, "Oh, but we miss our kids." So we were there crying together, and these are the two guys on the right there with their children. And it's interesting, that capacity for empathy they showed, I think it's directly connected to the capacity to ask questions and to have a sense of wonder in the world. Because really, empathy is this capacity to imagine your way into another person's perspective. And what concerns me today is that we see that empathy is actually on the decline. We see it among college students. We see it among all of us, actually. We see levels of empathy on the decline. And if you think about where empathy comes from, we see that in New Guinea, you might say, well, it must come from the fact that they share their lives. They share everything together. But I think there's even something more deep there. It's not just that this is distraction-free community living, but it's also the fact that they share their deaths. They share everything. All the trials of being human are right there to be shared with one another. And you get a sense when you watch people die, which you do when you live in a little village in New Guinea, you just watch people die. You start to realize how frail we all are, how vulnerable we all are, how we all face the same basic challenges of being human. And there's some deep level of connection that comes from that. There's a sense of shared vulnerability, and it's from that shared vulnerability that empathy blossoms. And that's why you see such empathy growing in New Guinea. But then you go to our society and you look at the technologies of the last 100 years. In the last 100 years, we've used technologies to essentially box ourselves off. We started living in boxes, traveling in these boxes, shopping in boxes where we don't even know the people that we're buying our boxes from, and then looking into these boxes to connect back to our society. And then over time, we've just moved to more boxes, moved in these boxes, shopped in bigger boxes, and looked through these boxes. And all along, we've ran into a problem, and that is that Robert Putnam has described as one where he says we're bowling alone. He says, through numerous statistical measures, he points out that we are essentially less connected than we have been in the last 100 years. And the technologies have really driven this in many ways. And it's an interesting thing, right? Because these technologies all hold the promise of allowing us to quest a little bit further, to invite new connections, to embrace our vulnerability, but they also allow us to not do those things in ways we've never done them before. Vivian de Couture says that we live in a capsular civilization, living in capsules, putting ourselves in other capsules to deliver us to our other capsules. And if you look at how this affects our kids and how we've all grown up now, I like to turn to a story by Peter White. He grew up in the 1950s, and Peter White talks about in the 1950s, he was allowed from a very young age to explore his entire neighborhood completely unsupervised. And then as he got older, he learned to ride a bike, and he could go a little bit further. And then as he got still older, he got into his teen years, he started hitchhiking, and he would hitchhike up to 100 miles or more in a day and be back before nighttime. And Peter White did all this because everybody was doing this. It wasn't just something he did. It was something that was actually encouraged. And he did all of that, even though Peter White is blind. And you go back to all those things I said, and you realize he was allowed and encouraged to go around his neighborhood unsupervised as a blind child. And he learned to ride a bike, and he had scars to prove it, but he was going to learn to ride a bike because everybody else did. And then you imagine putting your faith in strangers to take you over 100 miles and get home that very night. That's a level of public trust that we simply don't have anymore. And it has direct effect in how we raise our kids and how they encounter the world. So this is a picture which I wanted to contrast with. This is my friend in New Guinea. That's a real knife. I'm not sure if you see the difference, but... but this type of thing affects us on all levels, and it affects all of us, this sort of culture of fear, a risk society that we live in. As Brené Brown has said, we are the most addicted, medicated, obese, in debt, and busy adult cohort in human history. She says, these are all ways of numbing ourselves, and you cannot numb emotions selectively. So we're essentially using our technologies to find ways to numb ourselves from the possibilities of pain and rejection. But as you do so, you also lock yourself off from the possibilities of joy and connection. So I've been trying to kind of create a model of this so I can put this all together. And I call it the vicious cycle of the age of whatever. And this is what it looks like. We live in this age of whatever, which is basically, it means that we have a wealth of choices. You have to choose who you're going to be, what you're going to do with your life. And in that process, then the main thing that we all do is we try to search for ourselves. This is the main occupation of all of us. We're all trying to figure out who we are. In the process, we're trying to figure out our own authentic self, which is that self that's unique to us. And so as we do that, once we find something, once we make a choice in this world of infinite choice, we defend it. Sometimes we celebrate it. And so, you know, we'll hear sometimes people talk about the narcissism of our age. I think that's really just a defense mechanism to try and defend these choices that we've made in a world full of choice. But as we're all making these different choices, we end up with fragmentation because everybody's making different choices. So we end up in a world in which very few people actually share the same beliefs, ideas, ideals, values, interests, and so on. And this fragmentation ultimately leads to more complexity, and we end up with a sense of a loss of certainty, meaning, and power. And so we come back to this world of whatever with kind of throwing our hands up and saying, whatever. And it's in this environment that our kids are raised. And it's, of course, a very heavily media-saturated environment, and the messages are all about trying to answer that question. Who are you? How should you act? Who should you be? And these are the messages that are sent to our kids during this time. And you would hope that in this new environment, now we live in a different kind of world where stuff isn't just being pushed at you. It's actually a world that you go into and you can navigate it yourself. This is a sort of a do-it-yourself media environment. And you would hope that there could be some changes. So, for example, the one thing is that you can now ask questions and, you know, whether it's how giraffes sleep or whatever it might be, you now have this amazing world of information at your fingertips. You also have a capacity to connect with people in new ways. So here's a video that was one of the first really popular videos on YouTube from 2006, just after YouTube launched. This is your sort of quintessential lonely individual. This is what Robert Putnam was describing as a bowling alone kind of individual who came home to Sydney and didn't have anybody to give him a hug at the airport. So he goes down to the mall and holds up this free hug sign, and eventually somebody gives him a hug. And then this starts to spread. This is still kind of an old school social movement, you know, passing hand to hand, person to person, more and more people getting involved. So then it hits YouTube and it gets tens of millions of views, and almost instantly it creates a global social movement. It seemed to have tapped into something that resonated with lots of people around the world who were feeling a little disconnected. And so this free hugs movement spread to thousands of places around the world, thousands of these events happening, and they're all organized using new technologies. There's something else interesting in this new media environment. It's not just that things like this can spread so fast, they can also be mocked and spoofed really quickly as well. So
these are really, really good. And they're not as smelly as the hippie hugs.
And sometimes these spoofs are really serious, right? So that was kind of a funny one, but sometimes they get serious. That commercial I just showed you where the young girl was getting blasted with media, that was a Dove commercial. And some young guys realized that Dove makes a lot of their products with palm oil. And they thought, well, That's interesting. You know, here they're making a very moral statement, but at the same time, they're using palm oil, which is destroying forests all over the world. So they decided to make a remake of that video to make a statement, and this is what it looks like. So this video got about 1 million views in 2 weeks, and the two guys who created this were invited to the table with Unilever, which is Dove's parent company, and Unilever signed a moratorium on rainforest deforestation in Indonesia. So this had an immediate effect. So you start to get the sense that this is no longer a one-way conversation. This really is something different. But studies of young people have found that instead of engaging this media in effective ways, what we often see is summarized here by Thomas de Zengotita. He says, in the midst of a fabulous array of historically unprecedented and utterly mind-boggling stimuli, whatever. And you know, I don't blame kids for this. I blame us. I think we are the problem. If you look at the walls in which we create our schools, and you think about what those walls say, you think about what students are doing when they're sitting in a classroom, a large lecture hall, and you realize that students learn what they do. If students learn what they do, what are they learning when they're sitting in a large lecture hall? They're learning first and foremost that the information is up at the front of the room and that they should follow along. They're not learning creativity. They're not learning critical thinking, regardless of the content you deliver. So what we did in this video is I invited my students. I teach these large classes, you know, big lecture halls. And I just invited them in on this Google document to describe what it's like being a student today. And we just started editing this document together, creating the script for the video that you're watching now. And you can see there's a number of blank spots there. Those are spots where we felt like we needed to survey ourselves to sort of find out the numbers that we wanted to put in there. And this video just kind of runs through some of the big issues you might have in a large lecture situation. And I won't bore you with all of this. You can check out the rest of this on YouTube if you're interested. What interested me the most for this is things like this. Two knowledge machines colliding in our time. The knowledge machine of the university, which is previously the most amazing knowledge machine on the planet and still might be the most amazing knowledge machine on the planet, now collides with this other knowledge machine, which most of us have in our pockets. And it enters this university as a distraction device. So we have students Facebooking in class, bringing their laptop to class, but not working on class stuff. This one is legit because her instant messenger came up just as she showed this. I mean, you know, this is really bad news. And if you think it's bad news just for the level of disengagement, it goes a lot deeper than that. If you start paying attention to the questions students ask in this environment, now we're talking about young, vibrant, intelligent, creative people placed in this environment, suddenly start asking questions like, how many points is this worth? How long does this paper need to be? What do we need to know for this test? These are not the questions that are going to burn in their soul forever. These are not the questions that are going to lead them on a lifelong quest. So something needs to change. Of course, the questions we're asking aren't that much better. You know, these multiple choice questions, which they could grab any of the answers from the air all around them. You know, it goes even deeper than this. David Hastings had this wonderful insight. He had these physics students out in Arizona, and they were getting about 80% in his classes. And then he decided, he had a colleague who had this other test that he gave that didn't have any numbers on it. There were no formulas to apply. It was just basic physics knowledge. Things like, if two metal balls are the same size, but one weighs twice as much as the other, and you drop them, which one hits the ground first? And it turns out, with questions like these, students who are getting 80% in physics classes are only getting about 40% of these right, barely better than guessing. Which is to say that these students are learning how to take physics exams. They're not learning physics. And, you know, Eric Mazur over at Harvard thought, you know, that might be true in Arizona, but I'm at Harvard, you know. And it turns out the same is true at Harvard. And, you know, one of the most disheartening things I've seen is when you look at the winners of our education system. This is Erica Goldson, who's a valedictorian out in Georgia. And she took the stage and she said this. She said, "Why did I even want this position? Sure, I earned it, but what will come of it? I have no clue about what I want to do with my life. I have no interest because I saw every subject of study as work, and I excelled at every subject just for the purpose of excelling, not learning. And quite frankly, now I'm scared." What she was discovering in this moment of reflection at the end of this highly successful high school career was that she had no questions burning in her soul. She had no passions. And I've seen kids like this. I've done a lot of research now trying to find students with passion and try to find out what's making them tick. And it's always, almost always a question. So for example, sometimes they're real simple questions. This is Patrick Huffless. He's a high school kid in Kansas. And he was just flailing. He's losing his passion for his work. He was slipping into a C range. This is typically a student who could have straight A's. And then he got inspired by a question. The question was pretty simple. He wanted to create an app. He wanted to create games for the iPhone or for his Android device and so on. And suddenly the whole world opened up to him in a way it hadn't been opened before, because it wasn't just that he had to learn how to program. He realized if he was going to create a game that, say, it's like Angry Birds, he was going to have to know physics. If he was going to create a game about that used any sort of history, he was going to have to learn history. And suddenly every subject was enlivened for him, and he was just dancing through all these different classes, embracing all of his subjects. And eventually he produced this app here for Orange Leaf. This is another kid. This is Hunter Browning. Hunter Browning has a very big dream, a big quest, you could say. And his quest is he wants to create a car that runs on water. Now, if he succeeds, this will disrupt a $900 billion industry. So this is a pretty big project. But nonetheless, he proceeds. And in the process, he's learning, you know, just a tremendous amount. I've interviewed him in the middle of this, and I was just overwhelmed with his capacity to show me how these different things worked. And I said, "How are you doing this?" And he said, "Well, I've basically taken every class in this place twice." And I said, "What do you mean by that?" And he said, "Well, I took all the classes once, and now I go back to everybody as mentors, and they help me as I try to piece this thing together." And if you guys, you know, are familiar with how difficult it might be to create a car that runs on water, you can see this is a pretty lofty goal. But he goes in and he tries it. He creates a little fuel cell. He hooks it up to a Jeep Cherokee that somebody donated for the purpose. And he tries to crank it over, and it won't start. So he's failed. But this is the beautiful thing about living with questions. Failures are just signs on the road. They're not an indication of who you are as a person when you have a question burning in your soul. It's just a sign that, let's try something else. And so he connected this thing to a grill, and he can actually now cook hot dogs and hamburgers with a couple gallons of water. And he's thinking about starting a company called Green Grills. So we'll see where that goes. And then there's people like Sean Ahmed. Sean Ahmed was sitting in a forum not unlike this one, and Jeffrey Sachs had come to talk. And Jeffrey Sachs said, "We can end poverty in our lifetimes." And, you know, Sean was thinking, "Well, it's not happening if I'm sitting in a big lecture hall." And so he moved to Bangladesh. He took a camera with him. He started making videos about what poverty actually looks like in Bangladesh. He, in the process, got about 279,000 Twitter followers. And all these people wanted to help. They were seeing poverty in its rawest forms displayed on YouTube. And they wanted to know, how can we help? So he had to come up with a way to let them help, and so he created this.
You guys, through your votes and video responses, will decide how I will be spending some of this donation money.
Hi, Sean.
Hey, Sean.
Hey, Sean.
We donate it. We were very, very glad to do so.
Here is my vote. Rebuild the school.
If you listen to the music there, there's a wonderful kind of parallel or analogy there. That music was actually created on open source sound, which is itself a collaboration of people from all over the world who are finding their passion, finding some sort of a voice, something to put out there. And so what you're hearing there, for example, is Colin Mutchler putting his guitar lick out there. And then Cora Beth, who's clear across the other side of the country, hears this and decides to add her violin. And then Vavrek in the lower corner there, decides to grab some drum beats and adds that last piece. So this is a collaboration taking place across time and space, among people who are essentially embracing what I think of as the quest. They are embracing their vulnerability, inviting connections with one another, and creating something much more profound than any one of them could do on their own. Which takes us back to this vicious cycle of the age of whatever. What these people have discovered is that it's not just about the search for self, that there's something more profound that you can do. And it starts with something really simple. You realize that it's not just about you, it's about all of us, that collectively we make the world. The world, and we make the world around us, we make the world inside of us, we make the world in these different ways. And so it's not just about defending and celebrating yourself, you start to embrace your vulnerability and realize that vulnerability is something you share with other people. Suddenly the fragmentation doesn't look like fragmentation. It looks instead like this wealth of diversity that you can embrace because other people might have other ideas than you have, and that could be a good thing. That's a space for you to invite connections. And the complexity doesn't look like complexity anymore. It looks like a space where you can, it's almost like a symphony, and you can join in this symphony. And there's no longer a loss of certainty, meaning, and power. Instead, you feel this sense that you can celebrate what there is, because it really is a magnificent thing that we have collectively created together. And yet, also realize that there's more to be done, and you might pursue the possible. So you end up coming back to whatever, not with the sense of throwing up your hands up and saying, whatever, but instead having the sense of, you know, let's do whatever it takes by whatever means possible. And this I would call the virtuous cycle of the age of whatever. And now you might think what I've been saying here is like, you know, you all need to go find a way to go save the world. But it's actually a lot more simple than that. It's actually more like putting yourself in a state of wonder and having a sense of reverence for the world. And I want to show you, this is a film taken in Wellington, New Zealand last year. And this is a place where it never snows. So when it did snow, people were caught off guard. And what you see is like a study in the state of wonder. These are people who are in the state of wonder. And you'll notice one thing about them. They embrace it. They love the discomfort, right? People aren't bundling up their coats. People aren't running into the stores to escape the cold. They're running out into it. This is what wonder is like. This is what it is to live with questions. You just want to experience everything. You want to experience each other. You want to connect with each other. You feel more connected to everybody around you and the world itself. It feels like a celebration. And even a simple walk can seem enchanted. You start to get the sense that everything matters. And there's this beautiful thing about wonder, to live with questions. There is like two sides of it. On the one hand, there's this sense of awe, this fascination, but that quickly turns to a mode of investigation. You want to know more. The more wonderful and mysterious the world seems to you, you want to know more and more about it. And these two things can actually play off each other. So the more you learn, the more you want to learn. And then the more you want to learn, you come back to this sense of just sitting with the world like a child again. You start to see connections where you thought there ought not be connections. You start to see this sense, I love this scene right here, of just every little thing mattering, even like the footprint in the snow. There's this really simple mistake we make when we think about what it is to live with questions or live with wonder. If you think about wonder itself, you think of it as an experience. You think of it as what you just saw. You think of it as something that comes to you. But what I need to tell you is that it's not unlike love. Love is also mistaken as an experience. And you spend a lot of your younger years thinking, you just kind of preparing for that experience. Like if you're a guy, you try to be really cool. If you're a girl, you try to be really hot. And then you hope that you connect in some way and have this experience of love. But as you get older, you start to realize love is something you do. It's a capacity. You can get better at it. And wonder is the same way. Wonder is not just an experience. It's not just going to the Grand Canyon and being in awe. Wonder is something you can get better at. You can develop a capacity for it, and you can find yourself in any moment having that sense of just absolute wonder and connection. And that's, I think, the best gift you could ever take from your experiences here at BYU. Thank you.